Hello, and welcome to this week's Science Podcast. I'm NPR Science Editor Alison Richards. This week, we're going from underwater to outer space, from the massive oil spill in the Gulf to the fight over President Obama's plans for NASA. But we stay on Earth too. There's evidence that lizards are going extinct because it's getting too hot, and new information about a mammoth that's been extinct for a very long time. But we start with oil. NPR obtained an exclusive reassessment of the amount of oil gushing out of the Deepwater Horizon pipe. When BP released seafloor video of the gusher, science correspondent Richard Harris asked three scientists to analyse that video. The new calculation showed that the amount of oil spilling from the pipe is far higher than the 5,000 barrels a day estimated by the Coast Guard. Instead, the figure could be between 5 and 10 times that. Here's NPR's Richard Harris.
BP has repeatedly said there's no reliable way to measure their oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico by looking at the oil gushing out of the pipe. But scientists say there are actually many proven techniques for doing just that. We asked Professor Stephen Worley at Purdue University to analyze videotape of the seafloor gusher. He literally co-wrote the book on a technique called PIV.
PIV is short for particle image velocimetry. And conceptually, it's a very simple technique.
A computer program simply tracks particles and calculates how fast they're moving. Worley put the BP video of the gusher into his computer. He made a few simple calculations and came up with an astonishing value for the rate of the oil spill, much higher than the official estimate of 5,000 barrels a day.
70,000 barrels a day.
Plus or minus how much?
Oh, about 20%.
How confident are you in that?
Well, I'm quite confident that it's within the bounds that we've just discussed.
Given that uncertainty, the amount of material spewing out of the pipe could be anywhere from 56,000 barrels to 84,000 barrels a day. It is important to note that it's not 100% oil. The very short video BP released starts out with a shot of methane.
And at the end, it seems to be mostly oil. And so there's potentially some fluctuation back and forth between methane and oil.
But assuming that the lion's share of the material coming out of the pipe is oil, Worley's calculations show that the official estimates are way low.
We're talking more than a factor of 10 difference between what I calculate and the number that's being thrown around.
At least two other calculations back him up. Timothy Crone from the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory uses another well-accepted method, different from Worley's, for calculating fluid flows. He says the flow is at least 50,000 barrels a day. And Eugene Chang at the University of California, Berkeley, got a similar answer just using pencil and paper.
I actually teach a class where the whole point of the class is to estimate things based on very limited amounts of information.
Without even having a sense of the scale from the BP video, he correctly deduced that the diameter of the pipe was about 20 inches. And though his calculation is less precise than Worley's, it is in the same ballpark.
I would peg it at around 20,000 to 100,000 barrels per day.
So that's 5 to 20 times larger than the number we've been using.
Yeah, if you're using numbers like 5,000 barrels per day, I would say that's almost certainly incorrect.
And given this flow rate, it seems that this is a spill of unprecedented proportions in United States waters.
It would just take a few days, at most a week, for it to exceed Exxon Valdez's record.
BP disputes these figures. Bill Salvin is a company spokesman.
We've said all along that there's no way to estimate the flow coming out of the pipe accurately.
Instead, BP prefers to rely on measurements of oil on the sea surface made by the Coast Guard and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Those are also contentious. Salvin also says these analyses should not assume that the oil is spewing from the 21-inch pipe, called a riser, shown in the video.
The drill pipe from which the oil is leaking is actually a 9-inch pipe that rests within the riser.
But Professor Worley says that fact does not skew his calculation. And although scientists hope that BP will eventually release a lot more video and information so they can refine their estimates, what they have now is good enough.
It's possible to get a pretty decent number by looking at the video.
This new, much larger number suggests that capturing and cleaning up this oil may be a much bigger challenge than anyone has let on. Richard Harris, NPR News.
on the Hill, Congress was not just considering the problems offshore, it was also looking at low Earth orbit. President Obama wants NASA to cancel its new rocket program and, when the shuttle retires at the end of the year, use vehicles developed by private companies to take crews into space. That proposal has made some people very unhappy, including the astronaut Neil Armstrong. In a rare public appearance, he came to Capitol Hill on Wednesday to express his concern. Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Neil Armstrong was the first man to set foot on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Since those famous words, he hasn't said all that much. Roger Lanius is a space historian at the Smithsonian. He says Armstrong limits his public appearances.
He does not enjoy the spotlight. He's made that abundantly clear over the years.
Unlike his fellow Apollo 11 moonwalker Buzz Aldrin, who recently cha-cha-cha'd on the TV show Dancing with the Stars. So yesterday, when Armstrong walked into a Senate hearing room, the cameras went crazy.
Neil.
Armstrong didn't speak long, but in his spoken and written testimony, he said he thought President Obama had been poorly advised. NASA is about to retire its aging space shuttles. The president wants to cancel the new rocket program NASA had been working on, and instead get astronauts into orbit using vehicles being developed by private companies. Armstrong was skeptical.
I support the encouragement of newcomers toward their goal of lower cost access to space. But having cut my teeth in rockets more than 50 years ago, I am not confident.
He said America could lose its position of leadership if it went too long without its own way to access space. And while President Obama wants NASA to aim for new destinations like asteroids and end its effort to return to the moon, Armstrong thinks it could be useful to revisit his old stomping grounds.
I do believe that there's value in returning to the moon.
Sitting with Armstrong at the hearing was the last man to walk on the moon, Eugene Cernan. Cernan said that he and Armstrong, along with Apollo astronaut Jim Lovell, had reached a unanimous conclusion.
This budget proposal presents no challenges, has no focus, and is in fact a blueprint for a mission to nowhere.
Another astronaut at the hearing, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden, said he appreciated their thoughts, but noted,
reasonable people can disagree.
And other big-name astronauts do support the president's proposals. Buzz Aldrin traveled with the president on Air Force One when he visited Kennedy Space Center. And Sally Ride has stated that the new plan is a bold strategic shift. Now it's up to lawmakers in Congress to listen to all of these space travelers and decide who's got it right. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And now, back to Earth. Scientists who study lizards say many local populations around the world are going extinct, and they suspect the cause is climate change. Scientists have been predicting that warmer temperatures could endanger some kind of plants and animals, and this new research suggests that process is already underway. Here's NPR's Christopher Joyce.
Lizards live in some of the hottest places on the planet, but apparently some places are getting too hot even for them. That's what Barry Sinervo has found. He's a biologist at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Biologists had told him that they were seeing local populations of lizards disappear. He crisscrossed the globe trying to verify those disappearances.
They'd seen local extinctions of lizards, and then, sure enough, we found them.
A local extinction means a local population disappears completely, although members of that species still exist elsewhere. These are called scaloperous lizards, also known as the fence or the spiny lizard. They are common and come in many colors and sizes. Most of the local extinctions are in Mexico, but Sinervo's team of scientists turned up local extinctions on several continents as well. The team measured temperatures where the extinctions took place and found they were, on average, several degrees warmer during the day than normal. But it was actually starvation that was killing them off.
They would get out in the morning on a blistering hot sunrise, and they'd be able to forage for about an hour, and then they'd have to hole up for about 9 hours of the day, and then maybe come out a little at the end of the day.
More time hiding in the shade means less time foraging for food. That's especially bad during spring when females need more food because they're carrying eggs. Sinervo and his team found no evidence that logging or development was eliminating lizard habitats. The scientists calculate that in Mexico, about 1 out of every 10 local populations has disappeared since 1975, and this occurred among many different species of lizard. Worldwide, it could be about 4%, and the team designed a computer model that predicts that the number will rise as the planet warms.
You know, people have this notion that climate change extinctions are at some point in the future. We have now crossed the threshold. We're entering the era of climate change extinctions. If it continues on with what we've seen, we're talking about incipient species extinctions worldwide due to climate change that are going to start kicking in, like, right in the next few years.
That's a calculation, he says, that gives him no pleasure.
You know, you discover things in science, and normally it's just this incredible event, right? Wow, I've discovered something new. And this has been the most burdensome thing that I've ever discovered.
It will be the subject of intense scrutiny from other biologists.
Biologist and lizard expert Raymond Huey at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Because I think most people who work with lizards will be surprised.
Huey certainly was. One reason is that lizards generally do pretty well in hot environments, but not all of them, apparently. One scientist who's seen this research says it's a reach to predict that other species of lizards around the world will respond the same way to climate change as the Mexican ones have. Some might be more adaptable, some less. But Huey says even if the extinction numbers are not exact, it's disturbing news.
All of the data point in the same direction. So I think, is it conclusive? No. Is it suggestive? Definitely. There are some times in science that one does something that one hopes is wrong. And I think all of us who study this problem hope that he's wrong. We don't want this to be true because we like lizards.
The research is published in this week's issue of the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Woolly mammoths went extinct thousands of years ago. But now a tiny part of those long-gone animals lives again. Scientists at the University of Manitoba extracted DNA from 3 woolly mammoths that were frozen in the Siberian permafrost. Then they recreated mammoth hemoglobin. That's the part of the blood that carries oxygen. That resurrected hemoglobin provided lots of new insights into how mammoths stayed alive in the ice age cold. Biology professor Kevin Campbell told NPR host Guy Raz all about it.
What were our previous assumptions about woolly mammoths? Was it just that we thought they had these long coats and that's how they were kept warm?
That's all we knew. That's all we could determine from what we could see with our eyes. Hemoglobin is a physiological process, and these do not fossilize. You know, what fossilizes are the bones and teeth. So up until this point, we've had no knowledge whatsoever of how any extinct animal has actually worked. Now what we're able to do is bring really key elements of these animals back in the lab and determine precisely how they worked. So the mammoth actually had to develop changes to its hemoglobin, and this allowed them to keep their extremities very cold for months on end, really, we believe. And this would dramatically reduce their heat loss and hence their energy requirements, which would be very advantageous for them surviving, you know, winter in the high Arctic.
So you extracted some DNA from fossilized bones of a mammoth, and you managed to use that to resurrect mammoth hemoglobin, which is unbelievable. How did you then inserted it into E. coli. How did that then become hemoglobin?
What we're able to do is to simply get the sequence from the mammoth. And we also got the sequences from the living elephants. And then we used a method called site-directed mutagenesis. And site-directed mutagenesis is simply an ability to change, let's say, a letter A in a DNA strand into a letter C. So we took the mammoth changes and we put them into the living elephant DNA and we put that into the E. coli. And then the E. coli simply followed the recipe. And from that, we could, you know, take it out, and it was red, and it bound oxygen, and it released oxygen, and it did everything that it would have done had it been inside that mammoth.
It's incredible. Now 2 years ago, scientists at Penn State managed to sequence a part of the mammoth's genome from a clump of hair, And they suggested at the time that it would take about $10 million to generate a real live mammoth. What's your take on that? What do you think?
What we did with one molecule, one very important molecule, is much like bringing a mammoth back is an entire baseball season. You can imagine how many pitches are thrown. You know, what we did was the opening day pitch. One protein to one mammoth is a very, very large step. And there's so many technological hurdles yet to. I would love to see a mammoth, but I'm not sure if I will.
All right. Well, if you ever get close to making a real woolly mammoth, please give us a call, because we will come up and visit you.
Yeah, I'll be opening my own little petting zoo.
A little mammoth petting zoo?
Yeah, that would be quite the thrill, I'm sure, for children all over Manitoba.
And the world, actually.
And the world.
In fact, I think many kids around the world would like to pet a woolly mammoth. Dr. Kevin Campbell is an associate professor of biology at the University of Manitoba. He led the research team that resurrected hemoglobin from a woolly mammoth.
And that's it for now. There's many more science stories on our website, npr.org, and we'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Alison Richards.